Let me introduce Larry Temkin. Larry Temkin is a professor of philosophy at Rutgers University. His fields of research include ethics, both normative ethics and meta-ethics, and also social and political philosophy. He's just published a book with Oxford University Press called Rethinking the Good, Moral Ideals and the Nature of Practical Reasoning. And he's also written numerous papers and a monograph on different aspects of justice and equality, and both of the talks you heard today have already referred to this work. So Larry's done a lot to strengthen the case for egalitarianism by responding to various tricky objections, and he's also highlighted the complexity of values like equality and justice, and he's also considered how we might actually think about the requirements of equality and justice in the real world. And one of the areas that he has looked at is health, so we're very pleased that he's agreed to come and talk to us. So he'll be talking about fairness and priority setting in healthcare, and all of you should have a handout. Anyone doesn't have a handout, let me know. Great, thank you.
So thank you very much for your introduction and for inviting me here today. I'm going to stand today because I have really bad back problems, and I've been sitting there, but if some of you have been watching me, you see me fidget, and I move, and I'm back, so it would not be so easy for me to just sit at one spot. It's easier for me to stand. I'd like to thank Adina and Kristen for organizing this wonderful conference, and thank all of you for sticking around on Friday afternoon. So growing up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where before the days of global warming, we basically had three seasons, damn cold, really damn cold, and winter, and where we took a somewhat perverse pride in having the fourth highest tax rate in the nation, because we actually believed that it was desirable to have a fine park system, good roads, and outstanding public schools and hospitals, I always felt a certain affinity for our neighbors to the north. In fact, I always thought of Canada as a kinder, gentler nation than my own, the kind of country the United States would be if we were civilized, and that we sometimes aspire to be in our better moments. Truth be told, I always felt I had a lot more in common with Canadians than with many of my fellow citizens from places like Alabama, Utah, Texas, or New Jersey, for that matter, where I've lived for 15 years of my life, I'm sad to say. Not really. I'm older now, but I confess that my view about Canada and Canadians remains pretty much intact, since to paraphrase a line from Will Rogers, made famous by Mae West, of course, I never met a Canadian I didn't like. Of course, that may all come crashing to an end during discussion, but for now, I can truthfully say that it's an enormous pleasure for me to be speaking here today. Given our time constraints, my talk will be the kind that I myself usually abhor. It will be long on bald claims and woefully short on arguments, but hopefully it will provide the basis for some discussion. An outline of the talk is on the handout. I don't use PowerPoint. Part one, introduction. Surely there are many important reasons relevant to our treatment of the ill. These may include virtue-based reasons of compassion, kindness, charity, or beneficence. Deontological reasons connected with positive duties to aid the needy. Consequentialist reasons to promote the best outcome, perhaps of a humanitarian, prioritarian, or utilitarian stripe. Political reasons connected with the importance of a government treating each of its citizens with consideration and respect. Or fairness-based reasons that may themselves reflect deontological, consequentialist, or political aims. Some reasons for helping the ill will be non-instrumental, person-affecting reasons, having to do with the way in which illness directly affects the quality of lives of the ill. But some may be instrumental, and perhaps impersonal reasons, having to do with the way in which helping the ill may promote other ideals, like autonomy or perfectionism, or may help contribute to a stable, well-functioning society. Ultimately, ethical priority setting must pay attention to the full range of reasons that bear on the question. Unfortunately, however, I couldn't possibly answer the broader question one might want answered in a 40-minute talk, or 4-hour talk for that matter. Namely, what are all the factors relevant for ethical priority setting, and how much weight should be given to each? So instead, I shall focus on a much more restricted topic. the issue of fairness. One justification for doing this is as follows. Many believe that fairness has a particularly important role to play in thinking about healthcare, as Norm made plain earlier on. Whether the question concerns human subject experiments, worries about exploitation in developing countries, obligations to the ill at home or abroad, rationing of scarce medical resources, or the justifiability of a single or two-tier healthcare system. But we need a much clearer idea of what fairness involves before we can accurately assess how much weight should be given to it in the prioritization of healthcare. Unfortunately, the notion of fairness is itself incredibly complex. So even with my restricted notion, focus on fairness, I can't begin to adequately address all of the many aspects of fairness that are relevant to the questions of healthcare. Accordingly, I shall proceed as follows. First, I shall briefly distinguish between various fairness concerns and note the one that I shall focus on, which I call comparative fairness. This is really brief. It was much longer in an earlier version of the talk, but to squeeze down, I cut quite a bit out. Second, I will then take up the question of whether, insofar as we're concerned with comparative fairness in priority setting, we should be concerned with fairness in the distribution of prospects or fairness in the distribution of outcomes. Finally, I will briefly address the role that individual responsibility might play, at least theoretically, in setting ethical priorities regarding healthcare. Part two, distinguishing different fairness concerns. As indicated, there are many different notions of or aspects of fairness. Let me roughly characterize a few of these. First, there's an Aristotelian notion of fairness, that it's unfair to treat two people who are alike in some relevant respect as if they were different in that respect. Second, there's a related notion of fairness that requires impartiality, where we think it would be unfair to favor one person over another merely on the basis of, say, race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, nationality, weight, or hair color. These notions are connected with the idea that in many contexts, it's unfair to treat people arbitrarily or capriciously. Third, it's unfair if I violate your rights or exploit you. Fourth, it's unfair if I break a contract with you or fail to abide by my agreement with you, lie to you in certain circumstances, or if I disappoint your reasonable expectations by failing to act in ways that I had purposely given you good reason to believe that you could count on me to act. Fifth, another notion of fairness is connected with any set of rules or regulations that are propounded by an appropriate authority or the reasonable conventions of a group or society. For example, it's unfair to circumvent a reasonable social policy for the provision of scarce medical resources on behalf of someone who is rich, famous, or well-connected. Sixth, many political conceptions of the just society have analogous conceptions of fairness. So, for example, for Marxists, it's unfair if the state doesn't take from each according to his or her ability or distribute to each according to his or her need. For Nozickians, it's unfair if the state forcibly redistributes anything to which someone had a legitimate entitlement. And for Rawlsians, it's unfair if the state fails to set up its principles and institutions so as to maximize the expectations of the representative member of the worst-off group. Note, since society's worst-off group will include those who are suffering from the most debilitating physical and mental illnesses, in Rawls's theory, a society will almost certainly have to set up its principles and institutions with an eye towards, among other things, improving the health of its sickest members. Seventh, there is a notion of absolute fairness akin to Ross's, W.D. Ross's, and Kant's notion of absolute justice, according to which there's something unfair about people being better or worse off than they deserve to be. So, for example, it's commonly thought that it isn't fair when bad things happen to good people. Finally, there's a notion of comparative fairness, akin to the notion of comparative justice or desert, according to which, roughly, it's comparatively unfair for one person to be worse off than another when she's no less deserving than her more fortunate counterpart, and in no way responsible for her predicament. On this view, it's comparatively unfair for some to be born while others are not. Sorry, some to be born blind while others are not. Interesting question, the other. Or for a child in Chad to be born with much worse life prospects than her American counterpart. This is a representative, though by no means exhaustive, list of conceptions or aspects of fairness. I think all or most of these conceptions have a legitimate role to play in thinking about the kinds of questions with which this conference is concerned. But since I can't possibly do justice to each of these conceptions in the remainder of this talk, I want to focus on the last conception, the conception of comparative fairness. This conception isn't necessarily more important than the others, but it is the one I thought the most about, and it raises a number of difficult and intriguing issues. Part three, fairness of prospects versus fairness of outcomes. This is relevant to some of the stuff Norm was talking about earlier. Fair opportunity plays a crucial role in debates about rationing. In the face of scarce medical resources, what system will ensure that among those who are similarly needy, everyone at least has a fair opportunity to have their health needs met? This is an important question. But I have deep reservations about thinking about fairness in a single realm, like healthcare, rather than in the broader context of which healthcare is a part. Accordingly, in this discussion, I shall mainly focus on fairness in the domain of life as a whole. If for pragmatic or theoretical reasons, we convince ourselves that it is legitimate to have a domain-specific focus, hopefully many, perhaps all of my remarks would apply, mutatis mutandis, to fairness in the domain of health. Two preliminary comments. First, there may be different ways of fully or partially satisfying the ideal fair opportunity. Second, here, as elsewhere, there will be other moral ideals that compete with the ideal of fair opportunity or provide reasons for fully or partially satisfying it one way rather than another. Efficiency is one, of course. We must not lose sight of this, even as we try to determine what we should seek insofar as we value the ideal of fair opportunity. Questions about whether and when we should be concerned about fair opportunity are relevant to several other topics, such as whether we should be concerned about ex ante fairness, fairness in people's prospects concerning the lives they might lead, or ex post fairness, fairness in outcomes concerning the actual lives that people end up leading. And similarly, whether we should be concerned with procedural fairness or with more outcome-related conceptions of substantive fairness, according to which an outcome that resulted from a perfectly fair procedure might nevertheless be substantively unfair and require amelioration. Given my time constraints, I shall lump these distinct but related topics together. In fact, I think there's reason to care about both ex ante and ex post fairness, and also about both procedural fairness and a more robust outcome-related conception of substantive fairness. In some cases, perhaps, ex ante fairness or procedural fairness will be all that's realizable. And in others, our main concern might be with ex post or substantive fairness. But in certain circumstances, the two will be intimately related. So, for example, under certain circumstances, whatever outcomes result from an initial situation that meets sufficiently demanding criteria for ex ante fairness or procedural fairness will, in fact, also be guaranteed to meet the most plausible conception of ex post fairness or substantive fairness. Moreover, under certain circumstances, no coherent account can be given of what ex post or substantive fairness demands, independently of certain favorable conditions initially obtaining that would at least partially satisfy the criteria for ex ante fairness or procedural fairness. I cannot fully defend these claims here, but let me offer some observations to help illuminate them. Most people recognize that in the game of life, each of us, to some extent, must play the cards that we are dealt. But they also recognize that sometimes our cards are, as it were, both dealt to us and played for us. On this analogy, the concern for ex ante fairness and procedural fairness reflects the concern that the deck should not be stacked against certain players, and that there should be no cheating in the play of the hand. So in the game of life, it will be patently unfair if, as it were, whites or men are always dealt better cards than blacks or women, or allowed to look at the hands of blacks or women before deciding what cards of their own to play. Ensuring that each person's hand will be determined by a fair deal and played fairly ensures that, in advance of the deal, the expected value of each hand is the same. And we can say that that meets an important criterion for ex ante or procedural fairness. But surely, insofar as we're concerned about fairness, we want more than just a fair deal and a fair play. I say we, that may distinguish me from some people in this room. Since by itself, that would do nothing to preclude the result that some people will in fact be dealt aces and kings, while others, no less deserving, and that's the key, will be dealt deuces and trays. That is, in the game of life, the cards don't have to be stacked against particular groups or individuals for it to still turn out that some are born with extraordinary advantages and hence life prospects relative to others. And that follows up on one of the earlier questions about natural versus social injustice. For most, this is deeply unfair, even if, in an important sense, it's clearly not as unfair as such a situation would have been had it resulted from a stacked deck of bias or discrimination. The preceding suggests that from the standpoint of comparative fairness, it's not enough if ex ante the expected value of each person's life is the same. Here, once reminded of an example first introduced by James Fishkin and made famous by Brian Berry. Suppose it was an extremely stratified society where one's life prospects were dramatically altered depending upon whether or not one was raised in a privileged or an oppressed family. Surely, such a society would involve tremendous unfairness in people's opportunities, even if, as it happened, at birth, babies were randomly assigned to the cradles of different families. The point, of course, is that prior to being born and assigned to their cradles, that is, ex ante, each person would have equal prospects. But their prospects would be dramatically unequal and unfair after they had been assigned to their respective cradles. And this is so, this is important, and this is so even if the process by which they were assigned to their cradles was itself completely fair, in the sense of giving no preference to one baby over any other. Likewise, it's evident that the ex ante expected value of two lives might be the same, even if they in fact face radically different life prospects. This might be so, for example, if one person faced the equal prospect of either a great life or a really, really bad life, while another faced the certain prospect of an average life. Their ex ante prospects might be the same, but they certainly face radically different life choice possibilities. Reflecting on ex ante prospects in the sense of the expected value ex ante of their lives might be the same. Reflecting on such possibilities, it seems that insofar as one cares about ex ante or procedural fairness, one should not merely be concerned with the expected value of different lives, either in advance of their coming to be or even at birth. Rather, for each kind of life L, with value V that someone faces at birth, with some probability, say P, it will be desirable everyone else at birth also faces a kind of life L prime with probability P that also has value V. It should be evident these considerations are relevant to a host of issues connected with pre- and post-conception testing, gene therapy and enhancements, and pre- and neonatal care. Suppose we fully achieved ex ante fairness or procedural fairness along the lines suggested previously. So each person faced an equivalent set of life prospects in terms of their values and probabilities. In this case, we would have met an important fairness goal, that no one should be disadvantaged relative to another merely by the circumstances surrounding their birth. But of course, there's nothing magical about birth. We wouldn't feel any better about the kind of scenario Fishkin and Berry describe if, instead of randomly assigning people to radically different stations in life shortly after birth, such sorting took place at the age of 13, or 21, or 30. But then why should we feel differently if instead of society sorting people into radically different positions at any particular age, nature or circumstances have such an effect at random ages in people's lives? Reflection on such issues reminds us that even perfect ex ante or procedural fairness is compatible with undeserved ex post facto differences of any size. And many will object to this precisely when and because it involves the substantive comparative unfairness of some being worse off than others, though they are no less deserving and not responsible for their lot. Consider a situation where at birth everyone faces an equal probability of living a very high quality life or a very low quality of life. Let us assume that this reflects a perfectly fair situation. And suppose that it will be pure chance, so that there's no charge of bias or discrimination, which determines what life they would ultimately lead. Even so, assuming that no one is less deserving than anyone else, it will be comparatively unfair if half the people end up with high-quality lives and half with low-quality lives. Ex ante and procedural fairness are desirable, but they are no substitute, so I claim, for ex post or substantive fairness. In such a case, at least, an outcome where each person lived a medium quality life instead would be substantively fairer. Next, suppose that the game of life was stacked, so that at birth, certain groups had a much greater chance of ending up well off than others. More particularly, suppose that some members of society had illegitimately arranged things so that as to give their children an unfair chance of ending up well off, at the expense of giving others an unfair chance of ending up poorly off. Suppose, for example, as a result of their machinations, their children had a 75% chance of ending up very well off, while some other children had only a 25% chance of ending up well off. Clearly, this would be objectionable from the standpoint of ex ante and procedural fairness. And there would be reason to try to prevent such unfairness in people's initial starting points, if one could. Still, assuming that neither the advantage nor the disadvantage were less deserving than the others, I remind you that children are not responsible for the deplorable actions of their parents. If, in fact, as a result of pure luck, both sets of children ended up living high quality of lives, there would be no reason to change the outcome from the standpoint of comparative fairness. And similarly, if as a result of pure luck, both ended up living very poor quality lives. If, on the other hand, as a result of pure luck, one group of children ended up really well off and the other poorly off, I believe there would be reason to favor redistribution between the better and worse off, whichever group was better off, whatever their ex ante situation was. Here it seems clear that the concern for ex post fairness and substantive fairness would dictate how one would respond to the actualized people ended up leading. And any concerns one might have about ex ante fairness or procedural fairness would play no role in that response. Might one then simply focus on achieving ex post fairness and not worry about ex ante fairness? I think not. Let me make several points regarding this. First, the concern for ex ante fairness and procedural fairness reflects the view that it not only matters how people end up, it also matters how they have been treated. For example, that they're treated with equal consideration and respect so that no one's discriminated against or otherwise dealt an unfair hand. Importantly, it also matters that each person be given a fair start from which to autonomously plan and lead a life of her own choosing, so that each person is significantly responsible for her own lot in life. Second, there may be some cases where ex post fairness is unobtainable or undesirable, all things considered, where it would be better precisely because fairer if the outcome resulted from an initial situation of ex ante fairness or procedural fairness than if it didn't. For example, in our world, there may not be enough resources to provide everyone with expensive life-saving technologies. And for a number of moral reasons, it may not be desirable to completely withhold such technologies from those who could benefit from them. Still, it would be better from the standpoint of comparative fairness if everyone who needed it had an equal prospect of being provided with such technologies, rather than having it determined, as it largely is today, by the country or family one is fortunate enough or unfortunate enough to be born into. Third, suppose that John is given an initial starting point that enables him to live a life ranging from medium to very high quality, while Mary is given an initial starting point that only enables her to live a life ranging from very poor to medium quality. Even if John and Mary end up equally well off, there's good reason to worry that the outcome was comparatively unfair. Perhaps Mary, having done her best to take full advantage of her opportunities, ought to end up much better off than John, who may have knowingly frittered away his abundant opportunities. So, insofar as one cares about comparative fairness, one can't just ignore questions of ex ante and procedural fairness and focus on questions of ex post fairness. Because whether an outcome involves ex post fairness may itself depend on questions of ex ante or procedural fairness. But this raises a fourth important issue. One can't simply assume that Mary deserves to be better off than John based on the extent to which they differed in maximizing their potential. Perhaps if John had been given Mary's initial starting point, he would have acted as Mary, in fact, did, and similarly for Mary. In that case, perhaps Mary and John deserve to be equally well off after all, despite their completely different and seemingly unfair initial starting points. This shows that it may be important to promote ex ante and procedural fairness to ensure that people have sufficiently comparable starting points in order to make a meaningful judgments of comparative fairness. Furthermore, if, contrary to fact, one could ensure that people's initial starting points fully met the robust criteria for ex ante and procedural fairness, so in particular people had been dealt similar hands in terms of talents, temperaments, individual responsibility, and life prospects. And if, in addition, one could later remove or rectify the influence of luck on people's choices, so that ultimately each person was responsible for how they ended up relative to others, then someone concerned about comparative fairness would regard any resulting outcome as involving ex post fairness, even if the people ended up with lives of significantly different quality. Part four. Fairness, luck, and responsibility. Suppose one believed, as Derek Parfit does, that free will is an illusion, and that there's no meaningfully robust sense in which people are responsible for their character, commitments, or actions. One might then think that no one had ever had a claim to a moral claim to a superior predicament, and that all cases where some people were worse off than others in normatively significant respects would involve comparative unfairness. In that case, we might want to promote conditions of ex ante or procedural fairness as a way of expressing our commitment to treating people with equal consideration and respect, but we might also focus on equalizing people's conditions, confident that equality in outcomes would then be correlated with fairness in outcomes. Of course, we shouldn't lose sight of the earlier point that we care about more than comparative fairness of outcomes. We also care about utility, perfection, and other ideals. Still, on such a scenario, it might be fairly clear and straightforward how we should respond to the world insofar as we are concerned about comparative fairness. Note, by the way, that while a conception of absolute justice or fairness presupposes that it's possible for people to deserve to be at one level or another, a conception of comparative fairness makes no such commitment. It is enough for such a notion to get a grip on us if we think it's unfair for one to be worse off than another who's no more deserving, and in a world where no one deserves anything, that condition will always be met. I'm often tempted to Parfit's view, but I confess that I am one of the many who believe that people often are, at least partially, responsible in a sufficiently robust sense for their characters, commitments, and actions. I wish that weren't so. It'd be a lot easier for my views if I didn't have to worry about this issue. Sadly, this raises a host of tricky questions for those who care, like I do, about comparative fairness. Before expounding on this, let me say a few words about the relations between the notions of comparative fairness and the notions of luck, fault, choice, and individual responsibility. For those who believe in a robust sense of individual responsibility, comparative fairness will involve such notions as moral desert, fault, and choice. But the exact relations between these notions is tricky. For example, we may think that among equally deserving people, it's often comparatively unfair for some to be worse off than others through no fault or choice of their own. But if someone is worse off than another, where it's his own fault or as a result of his own freely chosen actions, then it needn't be comparatively unfair. Thus, assuming that criminal John and citizen Mary are each fully responsible for their characters and actions, it needn't be comparatively unfair for imprisoned John to be worse off than Mary as a result of John's faulty choices. Indeed, it wouldn't be unfair for someone less deserving to be worse off than someone more deserving, even if the former is worse off through no fault or choice of his own. For example, it wouldn't be comparatively unfair if a fully responsible criminal were worse off than a law-abiding citizen, even if the criminal craftily avoided capture, and so only was worse off because, through no fault or choice of his own, a falling tree limb injured him. Additionally, in some cases, it would be unfair for someone to be worse off than another, even if she were fully responsible for her plight, as when the worse-off person was so because she chose to do her duty, or perhaps acted supererogatorily in adverse circumstances not of her own making. So, for example, if I'm unlucky enough to walk by a drowning child and I injure myself saving her, it may be comparatively unfair that I end up worse off than others, even though I am so as a result of my own responsible free choice to do my duty or act supererogatorily to help someone in need. Notice then, luck itself, note to the lucky egalitarians out there, is neither good nor bad from the standpoint of comparative fairness. Luck itself is neither good nor bad from the standpoint of comparative fairness. Luck will typically be objectionable if it leaves equally deserving people who have made similar choices unequally well off. But it will be unobjectionable if it leaves equally deserving people who have made similar choices equally well off, or unequally deserving people unequally well off, proportional to their choices or deserts. Thus, luck is to be approved or opposed only to the extent that it promotes or undermines comparative fairness. So again, I assert without argument. Following Ronald Dworkin, some people distinguish between option luck, luck to which we responsibly open ourselves, and brute luck, luck that simply befalls us unbidden. This distinction's advocates believe that any option luck inequalities that result from people's autonomously choosing to gamble or invest in the stock market are unobjectionable. By contrast, brute luck inequalities, such as being born with less intelligence or suffering from an unavoidable accident, are objectionable. I reject the way the option luck, brute luck distinction is often invoked. In particular, in part, This is because drawing the line between them is difficult. But more importantly, I believe that it is objectionable if Mary takes a prudent risk and John an imprudent one, yet Mary fares much worse than John because she is the victim of bad and he the beneficiary of good option luck. Likewise, if Mary and John are equally deserving and choose similar options, but John ends up much better off than Mary because he enjoys vastly greater option luck, I believe there is an objection to the situation based on comparative fairness. As with paradigmatic cases involving brute luck, in such a case, Mary ends up much worse off than John, though she's in no way responsible for her relative misfortune. This seems to me patently unfair. It's a case of comparative unfairness to which one should, I think, object. This discussion is, in theory at least, relevant to many practical issues of public policy, including issues of health care. In theory, at least, I emphasize. If it is true that people can have personal responsibility for their actions in a way that's compatible with the meaningful conception of desert, and I stress that this is a big if, but one that many accept, and that I shall assume for the rest of this discussion, then for all the reasons suggested above, not all substantive inequalities will involve comparative unfairness. This has deep and important implications for the nature and extent of our obligations towards the less fortunate, whose predicaments resulted from their own fully responsible choices regarding job selection, lifestyle, risky behavior, and so on. Clearly, this issue's scope is too large to deal adequately with here, but let me just make 6 relevant points. I think the handout has 5, I've added a 6th. First, the starting point of our discussion is that the mere fact that some are much worse off than others does not mean that there's reason to aid the worse off from the standpoint of comparative fairness. This will depend on the facts of individual responsibility pertinent to the case. Second, even if there's no reason of fairness to aid the ill, other powerful normative considerations may dictate doing so. These may include maximin or prioritarian considerations, humanitarian considerations to ease suffering, utilitarian reasons to promote the general welfare, virtue-related reasons of compassion, mercy, beneficence, and so on. As noted earlier, we have to be sensitive to the full range of reasons for aiding the ill, in addition to considerations of fairness. But third, where the other morally relevant factors are sufficiently close, reasons of comparative fairness may well help determine who among the needy has the strongest claim on scarce resources. So, for example, if one had to choose between who gets the last available bed in the ICU, perhaps it ought to go to the innocent pedestrian rather than the injured drunk driver who struck her. Or perhaps it should go to someone struck down by an unavoidable illness rather than to someone with a debilitating condition that could have been prudently avoided. Fourth, regarding comparative fairness, it's crucial that one determines appropriate comparison classes so that one is comparing all relevant types of behavior in the same way. For example, if one downgraded the medical claims of AIDS patients who engage in unprotected sex, as some are inclined to do, perhaps one must similarly downgrade the medical claims of pregnant women who engage in unprotected sex, as fewer are inclined to do, or the claims of obese stroke victims who did nothing to curb their indulgence of rich foods. Comparative fairness requires treating like cases alike. Fifth, in accordance with my point about option luck, it's important regarding comparative fairness that one not merely compare the losers of those who make poor choices with the winners of those who make good choices, but that in addition one compares the winners and losers of both categories with each other. Most smokers don't develop lung cancer. Sorry. Most overeaters don't have a stroke, and most helmetless motorcyclists don't end up in the emergency room. Thus, regarding comparative fairness, one must bear in mind that full responsibility for one's choices doesn't automatically translate into full responsibility for one's predicament. Indeed, as Kant rightly saw, the two are only loosely and coincidentally connected. Correspondingly, comparative fairness requires that we pay attention not only to actual outcomes, but to considerations of expected utility. More particularly, comparative fairness will require that we pay attention to the extent to which different people end up better or worse off than the expected values of their choices. Finally, just as it's comparatively unfair if someone is worse off than another who has made similar choices and is made no more deserving, so it's comparatively unfair if people's relative well-being is not proportional to their choices and desert. So small differences in desert, or the normative significance of one's choices, should not be correlated with large differences in people's well-being. And similarly, mere differences in the timing of one's choices should not have undue influence on one's overall lifetime well-being. This means, in particular, that consistent with other social goals like efficiency and utility, people should, in principle at least, have meaningful and informed opportunities throughout their lives to change their characters and life plans with corresponding changes in their well-being. Concluding remark. In this talk, I've been focusing on one aspect of fairness, one out of many, comparative fairness. I believe that theoretically, at least, this aspect is of great importance for the desirability of different alternatives in general and for a host of healthcare-related issues in particular. Having said that, however, there are powerful moral, political, and practical reasons of the sort W.D. Ross alerted to us too long ago, and that Norm rightly worries about in his thinking, that may severely limit the role that comparative fairness can actually play in any feasible healthcare system or policy. This is a point to be taken very seriously, but unfortunately, I cannot pursue it here. Perhaps, if some of you are interested, we can take it up further during discussion. Thank you very much.
So, should we start with Colin?
Yeah, thanks very much. There's so much I agree with in what you've said, but I am curious about a couple of claims that you made. I mean, one thing I wanted to observe is that just reverting a little bit to some of the things in Norm's talk, if you allow there's such a thing as pure procedural justice, the distinction between ex ante and ex post will come apart in those cases, right? Because there won't be ex post will be defined by ex ante, right? Because that's a defining feature of pure procedural justice. So I just note that because I wonder whether it stands in the way of one of the claims you made, which struck me as a little bit surprising. And so you wanted to preserve the value of both types of fairness, ex ante and ex post, and allow that the outcomes they generate can diverge.
Yeah.
But to insist that where they diverge, we don't always have reason to favor one over the other. Right.
To insist that where they diverge. Right. So I'm not sure I said that, but anyway, go
on.
Well,
I thought you wanted to allow that there would be cases in which we would not. I guess my question to you was whether there are any cases in which there's a divergence between just only on fairness grounds, divergence between ex ante fairness and ex post, that we would stick with the ex ante outcome.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, good question. I can give you an answer, or do you have more?
I thought you said yes. And that surprised me.
So I don't recall actually taking the stand, but I think it's intuitively insightful of you to see that I might have said yes. I do think these are two different values. I do think they do come apart. And here's the and then accordingly, there's a question of do you weight them and do you trade them off? And if you do weight them and trade them off, is it possible that there's some cases where they come apart where you would go one way and possible where they go the other way? And your thought is, if they do come apart, shouldn't we always go with a substantive justice? And my thought would be no, and let me just very quickly say why. So the very quick answer to this is You can have large degrees of substantive unfairness or very small degrees of substantive unfairness. You could also have very large degrees of procedural unfairness or very small degrees of procedural unfairness. If I imagine a case where we had very large degrees of procedural unfairness, so we had, you know, in fact, we had tremendous inequalities in the original situation, people were dealt terribly unfair hands, all this other kind of stuff, and there was a lot of racism, discrimination, unfairness involved, then the how we're treating people, I'm making that procedural unfairness, really, really bad, but now luck enters the scene. And it turns out there's these teeny tiny little differences in how it ends up, right? And now you say, well, we could either, I mean, I'm imagining now this possibility, you know, we could stick with a world in which we have this kind of thing and this little thing, or we could have perfect fairness here, and let's just imagine that it was correlated with a little bit more substantive unfairness, but perfect fair. I might think overall that's fairer and better. So the thought here is just that each of these different domains of fairness range in the degree of severity, could be little bits that are bad or really, really bad on both sides. And if I had to choose between an outcome that was really, really bad in one domain but only a little bad in the other, that's one way the whole picture goes. The other one, perfect here but really bad in the other or everything in between, I could easily flip between them.
Well, I guess...
Think of it this way. Well, never mind. I'll give it... But take any two values that aren't within the thing. Just take... You cared about equality and freedom, or freedom and utility, or something like that. Unless you think one has lexical priority, which is in essence what you're asking me, why wouldn't we give lexical priority? There's always in theory some case where the degree of freedom here is so great and the degree of this other value here is so small that we go with freedom, but other cases where it goes the other way.
Well, I guess I'll have to pursue
it. Yeah.
But in a way it goes to the second question, that has to do with the characterization of ex ante or procedural fairness, right? Because I think the way you were inclined to view this was sort of in a equal odds sense, right? The prospects were the same for the people, right? Someone might think that that's not a complete specification of ex ante fairness, right? That is, so there might be reasons internal to ex ante fairness to be sensitive to the stakes, right? That, you know, it's not a fair bet. You know, someone might say ex ante, if we have an equal chance on a coin toss for one of our lives, right? Might say, that's just not a fair bet. It's not unfair along the equal odds thing, right? But it's antecedently an unfair bet, right? So the characterization of antecedent fairness might be stake sensitive, right? And if it is stake sensitive, then I think some of the claims you were just making might be less obvious.
I think I'll just say that's possible. And that might even be right. And one of the things I said here, which is just, I'm not just saying it really is true, I blurred together a number of distinctions when I went ex ante, procedural fairness, expected value of something. A lot of the stuff which I think actually more carefully has to be teased out and separated. And I think that question is actually recognizing that, and I think that's right.
Nick is next on my list.
So I have a comment that I think supports your position, but I'd like your comment on that. Whenever I hear people talking about treating likes alike when it comes to health, the thing that always strikes me is there are no likes when it comes to health.
Yeah.
Right? So just to give an example, person A dies of a heart attack at 50, person B doesn't. Why? You know, we always like to say, well, person A was a smoker and person B wasn't. Or person A was obese and person B wasn't. In the real world, there are so many multifactorial choices and causes that play into the outcome that we can never tease them apart in a useful or I would argue even a philosophically sensible kind of way. And it seems to me that this kind of supports your position that comparative fairness comparative fairness matters, because any attempt to hang any useful distinction between people on anything else really doesn't take into account the facts of what what role our choices, our social position, any kind of luck may actually play in the actual outcomes. Because you ask any good epidemiologist and say, do we know why this person dropped dead of a heart attack? We quite literally do not.
So I will comment on that very briefly. I always hate it when people say things like this. But yes, I do agree with you. And so in some of my published writings on this topic, that there'd be no reason you would have seen some of these things where they end up that's so obscure. Or even the non-obscure, no reasons you'd see it. I do make all these various distinctions about different kinds of equality, different kinds of fairness, different kinds of justice, and I make a point about that particular conception of treating likes alike, the Aristotelian one. I call that equality as universality, and I'm not the only one to have made this point, but it's basically a purely formal requirement, which doesn't cut any ice anyway. I mean, if you just say, and that's in a way your point, you want to treat likes alike, now we have to decide. All blondes should be rich and all brunettes should be poor. Now you're treating likes alike. There's no substantive notion there. So in terms of what anyone's actually going to care about substantively, that's not going to distinguish different alternative views. You have to do hard work on another domain of fairness. It's purely a requirement of rationality of a certain kind, that notion, the Aristotelian notion. And similarly, actually, you know, Amartya Sen, you know, he has done so much really important work, but he has this whole book where he's talking about, you know, we're all egalitarians, you know. We're just arguing about what kind of equality we care about. I think that's just a big mistake. I mean, the sense of equality, I want to give this to Amartya because, you know, he's a friend and also a Nobel laureate, so now but I would have done it even if it wasn't Nobel. So there's a sense of equality where we're all egalitarians. I would call that equality is impartiality. We have to be impartial. But now we have completely different substantive views about what's required to treat people impartiality. So Nozick agrees that, you know, we should be impartial, you know. So he'll agree with that, but he'll say what it is to treat people impartially is, and something about freedom, blah, blah, blah. And then the Kantians will have a view about impartiality, and the Marxists, and so on. In a way, that is what the utilitarians are impartial in that sense. So that's, of course, what Marx is saying, you know. But then to say we're all egalitarians. No, okay, we're not all egalitarians. There are substantive egalitarians. People actually care about things like comparative fairness that distinguishes them from all these other different kinds of positions out there, and that's worth not losing sight of. I agree, so.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Larry. Just one quick point about ex ante and ex post, and it seems to me that theories I'm familiar with, or a theory that I'm fond of, actually takes both into account if you think about it. And from your description, you might have thought it was ignoring ex post. But if you look at, a Rawlsian theory, it's talking about picking grounds of justice, terms of cooperation that people can agree to, and you might think that's all ex ante. But one of the constraints is that people pick a principle that satisfies a condition of feasibility or sustainability and meets the strains of commitments, and so there's an ex post consideration as well. So I'm thinking I agree with you, and so do other theories I'm familiar with, and thinking both of these are dimensions of concerns about justice. I wanted to try to test with an example where comparative fairness comes in. So imagine we had the following sort of case. You could set the timer on a light to change crossing time for a street, and you could have a very long time, and then there might be some rate of accidents in that intersection. You could have a short time, and that would put a premium on people who can run fast and maybe would work against the elderly or some other group. But you could also have an intermittent time that would nab anybody that got caught in the middle and get run down. So you have a high accident rate. Now, would you view it as comparatively unfair if a reasonable time for the street crossing, chosen in some way to reflect plausible crossing times for most people, and they have to exercise some caution when they don't. But perhaps some people get caught and get hit by accident in that setting. Is that comparatively unfair to somebody who gets hit versus somebody who doesn't? Or is that underdescribed for you?
So it's slightly underdescribed. There's nothing you described. I mean, you started to give up different scenarios that would be comparatively unfair. Actually, you gave three. The way I interpreted your three is the first one doesn't involve comparative unfairness. The last one doesn't involve comparative unfairness, and the middle one does. So I had a clear sense of that as you described them, and then you focused on the first one. But
I was doing that in sequence. So,
right. So the point is, and the last one implicitly is asking me certain questions about related to questions like the leveling down objection and such. You know, if you set up a streetlight in such a way that everyone who tries to cross gets hit by the car, but it's everyone. It doesn't matter whether you're rich. It doesn't matter whether you're black. It doesn't matter what. There's no comparative unfairness there. And he's saying, yeah, so perfectly comparatively fair, but a really bad situation. And I want to say yes, no comparative unfairness in that last one of the three, but there's lots of things we care about besides comparative fairness, as I emphasized throughout that talk, so many, many reasons not to want to set up our lights like that. Now, you might, but this gets to an interesting question. It might be that there's no reasonable amount that you could set it, you know, a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, which wouldn't start to interfere with other things that we have to care about, such that someone's going to be disadvantaged. So, like, we managed to get most of the young, we managed to get most of the elderly, but that poor blind guy who's also really slow, suffering from arthritis, he or she's going to be hit. But if we don't do that, I mean, the traffic will never get through and people are going to die on other fronts. Okay. So here it's a simple, for me, a simple issue not of recognizing the many different things that we might care about. First of all, there might be local comparative fairness and global comparative fairness. And, you know, the mere fact that we're describing as locally comparatively unfair doesn't settle the whole question, right? You know, maybe he had lots of advantages elsewhere in his life, blah, blah, blah. Setting that aside, there will be some comparative unfairness when some people, through no fault of their own and not a result of their, you know, bad choices or the dilly-dallying when they didn't have to, get hit. But we had a trade-off because there's other things we care about, and sometimes those other things include comparative fairness in another place. You know, if the goods don't get through, then we can't help these people who are suffering here, and that would be comparatively unfair. So I'm answering your question in a roundabout way because the way you described it, you know, if there's unlimited time so everyone has a chance of getting across, no comparative unfairness
well,
there.
Let me be clear about what I was
what
trying,
you were trying
to
get me
at.
To. Okay.
What I was trying to see is whether you were packing into the notion of comparative unfairness some broader notion of unfairness that took into account all the other dimensions. And if you were, then maybe there's no disagreement between us. But if you weren't, and so certain cases were comparatively unfair, but they might get overridden by other things, then I'm beginning to wonder, how do you assign this comparative unfairness condition? Because it's not clear to me that it picks out a category of unfairness that I am concerned about. The speed of the light change was one way of trying to get at if you were recognizing that there would be some people hit or not hit on a perhaps random basis and we don't have any particular way of doing that, of distinguishing that, then maybe if you wanted to view them as that's a case of comparative unfairness no matter what, some got hit and some didn't and that's unfair, then my view is that, okay, if we speed this up and we have a policy of how to set the timer that is wrong and pretty clearly wrong, it may be creating some of the same kinds of comparative unfairness that you already judged in the other case, but it's missing something. So I wasn't
Sorry.
Clear.
So I'm still a little puzzled by the question because because in any, you take any value that you care about, You know, suppose you cared about utility, because that's easy to quantify and so on and so forth. And then you describe a scenario here, and it would, you know, that's what would be maximizing the utility vis-a-vis the crossing of the street. And then someone says, yeah, but if you did that, that would have worse utility over here. You say, yeah, okay, so then overall, insofar as you care about utility, you have to pay attention to the losses here, but the gains over here, and then you make a net claim. Now, similarly, I think I have, I won't say it's easy, because as you know from my first book, and as Yukiko knows, I mean, I think the notion of equality, comparative fairness, is itself extraordinarily complex with, you know, more than 9 different aspects that underlie and influence and push in different directions. So there's all sorts of complexities and difficulties. But I think we could come up with a notion of comparative fairness that's, for example, very distinct from some of these other notions of fairness that I was talking about here. I mean, you know, if you had a Rawlsian notion, you want to maximize the expectations of the representative member of the worst off group, and then that results in the following. You know, these people are lucky enough to be born extremely talented, and these people not so talented, and the way to maximize the expectations of the representative member of this worst off group is to raise these people to here, and these people come up to here, and that's the only way to do it. That's what actually maximizes it. Anything else, on a Rawlsian view and many views of that kind, nothing unfair about that. I think there is comparative unfairness. These people are worse off than them. It's not as a result of their own fault. It's not their choice, et cetera, et cetera. Are there gains in other domains, including other gains of in terms of Rawlsian conception of fairness? Sure, but there are losses in terms of comparative fairness.
Once again, I'll try it. what I was hoping you would do to distinguish our views would be to say it was always comparatively unfair for some people to be hit and not, and others not to be hit.
I do believe that.
And that's okay. Then that's exactly what I find problematic, because my view, and maybe it's because I'm looking at broader notions of fairness that balance other considerations, I would think some of these timing issues would be distinct. So I would think there's something really unfair about a timer that is intermittent and you can't predict when it's happening. And that is the result of a social policy that ought to be changed. But the fact that there are some people who will be hit or not under a plausible light, I don't think that's comparatively unfair. It may be unfortunate for them, but it may be the socially best way of setting the timer. And I don't think that kind of differential outcome for them should be viewed as a matter of fairness at all.
So this is just a long-standing and quite deep debate between me and Norm. I've been at many conferences with Norm, and we've always, this has always surfaced, and I'm happy to have it surface again. And you're absolutely right. Norm has two things going on here in this particular example. One is an issue of social fairness, and he also has this issue of, you know, if just someone's worse off than another, it's just bad luck. That is unfair. And if we had, as it were, a fair ex ante policy, that is, we had really good social reasons, not involving bias or discrimination, for adopting this policy, then he's inclined to think whatever results from that, including the fact that some people are going to be hit, that's not unfair. It's unfortunate, but it's not unfair. I don't have more to add other than that we have a different sensibilities about unfairness. I think that might be perfectly ex ante fair, perfectly procedural. There might be very good reasons having to do with fairness, but also other things that we value for society to settle on a policy, and that's a fair policy, i.e. a procedurally ex ante fair policy. But I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that you can have come up with good reasons for dealing the hand this way rather than that, and overall it works to the benefit of society, but some people get dealt aces and two kings, and some people get dealt deuces and threes, and they're not responsible for it all. And to me, that's as clear a case of unfairness as there could be, substantively unfair, ex post.
So Gopal Srinivasan, Duke University. since I didn't say anything before. Sadly for me, but maybe good for people later down the queue, I think you kind of took the legs out for my question by this side comment you made a few questions back. So I was going to say, it seemed to me that you were just running together two distinctions that are totally and cleanly independent, namely ex ante versus ex post as against procedural and substantive. But maybe what you said earlier was you sort of knew you were doing it.
I had to do that.
That's fine.
I had 41 minutes.
Yeah, so sorry. Fine. I give it up then.
But if you want to illuminate the audience on the niceties there, I don't mind at all because
I don't need to do that.
So.
I mean, but if you agree that they're different, absolutely. You're running them together,
absolutely.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I'll just be quiet.
Agreed.
Asked and answered. I also have the same question as GoPal, although had I the mic, I would illuminate.
I really don't.
Theater is probably a higher consideration in most people's minds than having themselves have to be illuminated by me.
I doubt that.
You don't know these people.
Yeah. Is there a last person you said then?
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
But I'll have I'm around afterwards. You can come up.
Well, no, the reason it seems to me.
Sorry, we have the queue, so.
Well, I just wanted to make one statement before. It seems to me that the last two speeches are contradicting the first one, and I don't feel that issue has been dealt with.
Martin, you're asking questions.
Yeah, thanks. I'm Martin Andersen from Copenhagen University. So I was a bit. I would pretend to be a lucky egalitarian right now, right? And I was a bit troubled about your responsibility concept. In the first sense, you said we should treat, this would be my first note, you said we should treat equal cases alike, right? And then you compared a case of homosexuals being risked of HIV and pregnant women, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the more correct logical way to put it would be that what we're comparing is responsibility for taking a risk of being worse off than others, right? And these risks would not be equally high, right? If you are homosexual and have unprotected sex in a homosexual environment, right, that's a much higher risk of ending up having HIV through presumably your own responsibility than if you, as a woman, have unprotected sex with your husband with whom you've been married, right? So I think that's maybe an unfair case. More generally, it seems that you assume free will to be a necessary requirement of responsibility. And me, myself, would definitely agree, but many people actually disagree on that. And I think when we have these talks about whether and to which extent fairness should be sensitive or insensitive to responsibility, it may actually matter which requirement we take to be the ones, which requirement we actually endorse as be requirements of the notion of responsibility. And we may have different conclusions, whether we assume free will in the sense of agent causality to be what responsibility requires, or whether it's merely some kind of mesh between first or second orders violations or preferences, right?
Good. So let me respond to both of those briefly because I know we are out of time. So vis-a-vis the first point, yes, these are only an analogy. It's not supposed to say it's exactly the same situation. I'm just trying to say if one says, I'm discounting the concerns of the health situation of these people. You know, they're about to die, but, you know, they knew there was a risk. And then you don't say something similar over here. That's illegitimate. So is it the exact same risk? No. Is it the exact? But, you know, there are risks of pregnancy. Someone gets pregnant and then various things. You know when you, if you.
But no one would say that people are responsible for the disease. They're responsible for the behavior that leads to increased risk of getting a disease.
Yeah, but the claim is that's exactly what's going on. You're responsible for a certain form of behavior in both cases. You're engaging in unprotected sex, and I'm assuming, in the case we're assuming, that you know that there's possible bad things that could happen either way. And then all I'm saying is just a very simple point here is comparative fairness requires in this context that if you're going to say, here's what's going on over here, all other cases of that kind could be lesser degrees, so, you know, blah, 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 have to, that's all I'm saying. So but I wasn't making any claims about the degree of risk is the same or anything, nothing like that. And the second point, I agree that's the marriageness of free will, and there's no way, if I couldn't even address these other things in 40 minutes, we're going to solve the free will debate. But I agree completely that, you know, whether or not one's a compatibilist, whether one's a first or a second or a person, this won't mean anything to you who epidemiologist, or maybe it will, but you wish it didn't. But yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, the question is a thorny one, and what should we say about responsibility, and what notion of responsibility would come into play, and then would there be different implications on your view depending on whether it's this or this? I think all that is yes, yes, yes. Thank you very much.